This is Ray Berry, interviewed by Chris Alden Lee on the 8th of July 2012. Ray Berry, Part 1.
The name is Raymond Arthur Berry, and the 28th of 11, 1929, and it was in Gillingham in Kent.
So how old are you now? 80?
82.
82, okay. Would you say your father was an educated man?
No, a sort of middle, you know, not poorly educated, but not well educated.
What did he do?
He was in the Royal Marines.
Was he?
Yes.
Okay.
He ended up as a colour sergeant, you know.
Is there a long military history in the family?
Yes, I think the Royal Marines have been, you know, people have from the family have been in the Marines for a long time, yes. It's a family regiment, really.
Yeah. What was your schooling like?
Well, of course, interrupted by the war. And I went to an ordinary, you know, local school. And then on to, very fortunately, I went into a grammar school in Canterbury. Not King's School, but Simon Langton. And I was there, you know, throughout the war. Saw half of it burnt down.
Half the school?
Yeah, in the Blitz, yes. And helped demolished part of it, but it was really exciting, of course, during the war for a young lad.
And traumatic as well?
Oh, yes, wonderful. I wouldn't have missed it for the world.
But having your school burnt down must have been a bit disturbing, surely?
Well, it was mainly the girls' section.
Well, that didn't matter then, did it?
No, not at all, not at all. And then, of course, we had a barrage balloon in the playground. Oh, it was really great. And that was my first meeting with RAF personnel.
But was your dad actually away at the war?
No, he retired right on 1939. He'd done 20 odd years.
Yeah.
And they said, "You've done enough, mate," because he'd been through the First World War.
Right.
And he'd been in the Dardanelles and all sorts of terrible things. And they said, "Right, you can leave the service now. We don't need you again." And it was very fortunate because a lot of his friends were killed at Narvik in the Norwegian campaign. So that was sad.
So were you... It's a classic image of lying back in a summer's heat and watching the Battle of Britain going on overhead.
Absolutely. And it was so exciting. You know, we didn't realise the death side of it. Mm. But we obviously saw a lot of people die in the sky.
Can you describe what you might have seen?
Well, one Sunday we saw what seemed like hundreds and hundreds of German bombers heading towards London. And
In broad daylight,
yes, about 2 o'clock in the afternoon. And only about three or four came back 2 hours later. They'd all scattered and had gone off in various directions. But that was the last daylight raid the Germans did.
They learnt their lesson, did they?
They did, yes.
So were the British Spitfires in amongst them?
Oh, yes, yes. But at various spots, you know, one section of the country would be anti-aircraft guns, and then there would be a section of balloons, and then there would be an overall area more out to sea, I think, for fighters to have a go at them. Mm-hmm. And, of course, we had the radar stations, you know, the Chain Home Low, in just near where we were, which... Of course, that was really why we won the Battle of Britain, because we knew where the planes were at all times, really. You know, it wasn't hit and miss.
Yeah.
You know, we intercepted the German aircraft because we knew exactly where they were. It was a tremendous advantage.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. And that stayed with you for the rest of your life, because I think you had mentioned on coming over just a few minutes ago that you have quite an interest in aviation.
Yes, I do, because... National service was 2 years in the RAF, and actually working on aircraft. You know, I was an engine fitter, working on Dakotas, and they just finished the Berlin airlift that had just come to an end, and we worked on the planes very near here, actually, Walter Beach and Bassingbourne.
Oh, right.
And I had a great time, loved every minute.
Did you go to the RAF straight from school?
Yes, I suppose I did, yes, yeah.
And they, that was where you learned about fitting planes? And
yes, that's right. Engines and things. Yeah. Yeah. And oh, it was marvellous. I even liked the square bashing, which is fairly unusual, I think. But no, it was all good. All good. And of course, you know, that was a good grounding in practical skills. I mean, before then, the only practical things I'd done was Meccano, as lots of children did at that time. But, you know, when to get your hands on actual aeroplanes with actual people who are actually flying is quite something.
Did you ever learn to fly yourself?
No. I would have liked to have done, but no, it never sort of came my way. Mm. It was always expensive to learn. But, I was quite happy with what I did.
And you went to the Antarctic as a meteorologist, so did you pick up any of that in the RAF?
No. I've always wanted to go to the Antarctic, just to backtrack a bit. In the final, sometime in the final 2 years of myself being at school at the Langton, they did a trip, a school holiday trip to Switzerland. And during that trip, of course, we had all sorts of exotic food which we'd never had throughout the war, but one of the things we did, we went to the top of the Jungfrau on the railway. And I don't know whether you know what I'm talking about, but you go up through the mountain in a tunnel and you come out right on the very, very top. And it was all white and blue and glaciers. And I thought, it's so wonderful. You know, I want more of this. So I thought, right, Antarctic,
So it was the scenery what got you, was it?
Absolutely. Well, I don't know if you've ever done it. Have you ever been up the Jungfrau?
No, but I have been to the Antarctic, so I know what you mean.
But it's all blue and white, but it's exactly the same. Hot summer's day down at the bottom, and at the top, you're in Antarctica.
That was quite an adventurous school trip, wasn't it, in the post-war years?
Yes.
Going across France?
Well, as the train meandered across France, every time we came to a bridge, the railway line diverted to a Bailey Bridge and crept very slowly across it and then accelerated again the other side. So virtually every bridge was gone and just a temporary Bailey Bridge. And lots of things like that stick in the memory, don't they?
They do, yeah.
Yeah.
Was the RAF a career then, or was that just National Service?
National Service, 2 years, yes.
So what happened at the end of that?
Well, I thought, you know, Antarctic, that's the thing I really want to do. And so I thought, right, I'll join the Met Office, get a job, which I know they'll want down there, and it'll increase my chances of being able to get there by possibly 90, 100%. And so I did 4 years in the RAF, working in the Met Office, and I went to Uxbridge, you know, the control centre for the whole of the airlines over Britain, and then on down to an aerodrome near Southampton Easley Airport, and then to a small airport near me, you know, doing observations and information for aircraft landing and taking off from the particular aerodrome I was stationed at.
So you were playing a long game, were you?
Absolutely.
To get into FIDS?
Yes, yes.
Did you actually enjoy the meteorology?
Oh, yes, it was quite good, except fish and chips at 3 a.m. is not my idea of heaven.
Yes, these are the night shifts.
Yes, terrible.
Had you had a previous interest in the weather over and above the usual British conversation?
Oh, yes. I'd always, you know, looked at the books for the pictures of clouds and, you know, the warm fronts and that sort of thing. I was always interested in that. And I think I gave the impression to the training we had in London for the meteorology, I think I gave them the impression that I was quite well up in it, but that's why I went to Uxbridge. But I didn't last very long at Uxbridge.
How do you mean?
Well, that was the control centre, and it was very important that the weather was, you know, super duper. You know, and every quarter of an hour, the information used to flood in by teleprinter to be annotated and decoded for the flight controllers to read. And that was horrendous, 10 minutes of work, and then nothing for another 10 minutes, and then a horrendous 10 minutes of work where everything went mad. You know, the miles of punch tape shot at you, and you had to feed that into... Oh, it was just a crazy... crazy atmosphere.
So this information was coming from other weather stations?
Yes, all round there, all round Britain.
Right, and was it arriving in telexes or...?
Yeah, telex and then on to punch tape.
In Morse?
Yes, I suppose so.
In code?
Some sort of code. And the people that had been in the Met Office a long time could actually read the punch tape. And I'm afraid I never mastered that. But they were very clever, you know, and obviously well practiced with it. And they could read punch tape. But, it was interesting. But as I say, after a couple of months, I went down to Southampton where the pace was a bit slower. And, I enjoyed that down there.
So had you calculated that if you did 4 years with the Met Office, then you would be ideal?
Absolutely.
For Bass?
Yes.
Right. And just going back a bit about your interest in the Antarctic, apart from the scenery, I mean, had you read about some of the heroes?
Yes, I'd read the books, you know, with Scott and Shackleton and Amundsen. And that was, you know, I found that fairly exciting, you know, and interesting, but it was that, the sight of the blue and the white from the top of that mountain that really grabbed me, you know, and I thought, yeah, this is terrific.
So the national heroes weren't necessarily your national heroes, or was Shackleton something of a speciality?
Oh, well, yes, that comes later when you get the finer points of the stories and you know, who you believe and who you don't believe, you know, that sort of gradually comes that Shackleton's a bit of a hero.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, after a while, we visited, you know, I did visit South Georgia where he's buried, and that all brings it, you know, more to life, doesn't it?
Okay, you're unusual amongst FIDs, because most FIDs just happen to spot an advert in a paper and
really?
Think, oh, I'll have a go at that. Whereas you actually had a game plan, didn't you?
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
So when you applied, which would be 1951,
52? Early 50, yeah.
1950.
Yes.
Okay. Were you responding to an advert, or did you just write to Bass?
No, I just
to FIDs.
Just applied, you know, to join.
And what was the response?
Yeah, I called in to interview, and of course that was a bit daunting. That was the first interview, and I think the only interview I've ever done, you know, for a job. And I thought, oh dear, I've done terribly here, and it's no good, and it's hopeless, and. They said, yes, you're in. I was absolutely amazed.
What do you remember of the day, the interview day?
Going up to London and in near the Houses of Parliament there, Longport, I think it was, or something like that, in the Crown Agents upstairs, all very official, you know, and a great long table and people sitting behind it, which were obviously Frank and Frank Elliott, yes, and Johnny Green and don't know who the other people.
Was Sir Vivian there?
No.
Vivian Fuchs?
No. Don't think so.
And did you get the feeling this was a testing interview, or was it just a kind of formality?
No, it was testing, I think. But, I mean, I had no experience. I had no coaching, you know, what to expect at an interview. And I couldn't sort of gauge what the impact or what sort of impact I should aim for. You know, I had no previous experience or knowledge of interviews, so I was completely green and... Just said what I thought, you know, at the time.
Do you remember any of the conversation? It's a long time ago.
No, I don't know, really.
Okay, 60 years ago.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So did they offer you the job then, there and then?
I think it came in the post just a day or two later. I'm not too certain about that. Yes, I think it came later, yes.
How did you break the news to your parents that you were going to go to the Antarctic for two years?
I just said, I've got it. Yeah, no, I was overjoyed. And they seemed pleased, so, you know. They knew I wanted, it's about time I did my own thing, rather than... Because life was very... You know, I'd been at school, been at home, living at home, and then in the RAF, every minute of your life's controlled by other people up to that point. And this was really the first big decision I'd ever made in my life.
It was a big one, wasn't it?
Yes, yes, yes.
Did you have at any point have any collie wobbles or regrets? Or?
No, never.
No,
I knew it was just the thing.
Well, there was quite a gap between you getting the job and you actually going south, wasn't there?
Yes, it would have been 8 or 9 months, I suppose.
Yeah.
Yes.
How was that filled?
Well, I was still in the Met Office, of course, still going to work. And then right up, I worked up to the last minute and then caught the boat at Southampton.
In the autumn of 52?
Yes.
Yeah. Yes. In the meantime, I gather you actually managed to get to the Festival of Britain.
Yes. Yeah.
What was that like?
Oh, tremendous. Yeah. I could remember quite clearly walking along the embankment and seeing the Skylon and the Shot Tower and all those things over the water, and then walking across the bridge at Charing Cross Station there, probably. Yes. And going up these various things, up the Shot Tower. And that was interesting, because they had a radar dish on the top of the Shot Tower, which was picking up thunderstorms all over Europe.
Oh, yeah.
And that was a thing that was actually working all the time. And you could see the great chain of thunderstorms over the
Channel.
No, over the, what are the mountains that separate Spain and France? The
Pyrenees.
Pyrenees, yes. Pyrenees is always thunderstorms. And they're brilliant. You know, you could see this great map and these thunderstorms sparking up.
So was this coming up on one of those green, sweet-type screens that we see in the Second World War films?
Yeah, that's right, and the map. Yeah, yeah, big, it was impressive display. Yeah. And, of course, a forerunner of what's every day now, isn't it?
So even then you were heading, when you got to the Festival of Britain, you were heading for the meteorological stuff.
Yes, yes. Yeah. Oh,
I think the FIDs had an exhibition, didn't they?
I don't know. I don't remember it.
Weren't there some Huskies there?
Possibly, yeah. Because the only other thing I remember is seeing all the brand new designs of, you know, irons and teapots and electric kettles and toasters and things, all the impressive designs.
All those things you weren't going to get for the next 2 years.
And then, of course, I think it was the Coronation Scott. A great big steam engine in the middle of it as well. I think one of the top-notch steam engines was on display there as well. Of course, I love steam engines.
Well,
don't we all?
Yeah. No, there was the Antarctic and the FIDs had an exhibition there as well, including Darkie, Sylvian Fuchs's Husky was on display.
Oh, right.
And I've got one of the FIDs I interviewed some while ago, who was here this weekend, has got a photograph of Huskies and Sledge going down the Chelsea Road
as part of the
embankment, as part of the prelude to the festival.
Oh, right.
Okay, so you were proud of Britain, were you?
Oh, yes. Yeah.
And couldn't wait to leave.
Well,
Did they give you any kind of training in that gap between being selected and departing? Any health and safety training? Or? No.
Health and safety? What's that? No, nothing like that. No. Not really. I suppose they must have gathered from interview that I would be quite happy outside. You know, I was an outdoors type
outdoors
person.
Boy. Yeah.
Yes. I don't know. But
so had you done mountaineering and that kind of thing?
No. Plenty of walking and cycling. And always been, you know, tennis, always been active in physical activity, sort of thing. Not a sedentary person.
So the big day came. You were in Southampton looking for the Biscoe.
Yes.
Which wasn't easy to spot, was it?
No, it was almost out of sight at low tide. You could easily overlook it. It was a tiny, tiny, tiny ship. But it was great to get on board and see where we'd be. I think my parents came down with me and marvelled at the bunk I would have and all this sort of thing. I seem to remember vaguely that. But it was nice to meet the other fellows that were going for the first time and sort of chum up with them. And as chance would have it, there was somebody at the Met station where I'd been working last picked up that I was going, and he'd applied and got taken on as well. So I had a chum.
Who was that?
A friend. Brian Kemp from Ashford, nearby. And he went down to Hope Bay.
All right.
Yes.
Would you have known at that point which base you were going to be sent to?
No.
That came later, did it?
Yes, yes.
Okay. They normally tell people on the Falklands, I think, didn't they?
Yes, I think so.
Is that the case with you?
Yes, yes. Okay. Yes.
So how was the journey south? Because the Biscoe is not the best sailing ship in the world.
No. The first trip out, I was a bit seasick, but it didn't bother me too much. You know, it wasn't a complete disaster. But it was excruciatingly hot in the tropics, and most people slept on deck. And, of course, the spot I chose to sleep was directly under the outlet of the captain's bath. So in the middle of the night, I got a, it seemed in the middle of the night, I got a douche of bath water.
I've not heard that before, that's good.
Yeah, it was all good fun. But I sort of moved my position a couple of metres and it was okay after that. No, we slept on deck in the tropics because it got terribly hot, of course, because there was no air conditioning or anything like that. And we had the meat from the freezer of the Bisco used to hang outside it where their bunks were defrosting. And so you get great sides of beef swinging in the as the ship rolled and just zooming past the end of your bunk. Which was not the best of circumstances.
You also got nightly invasions of fish, didn't you?
Yeah, flying fish used to come on board occasionally, yeah, and at night. And of course, it's wonderful to see the things, you know, flying fish, you'd read about them in books. But when you actually saw them skimming the water, it was quite, you know, amazing, really. You know, something I'd never expected I'd ever see. Mm. You know, flying fish, wow. You know, that's something else, isn't it? And of course, when you're on a small boat, you know, right down close to the water, you get a really good view of these things. And dolphins playing around the bow of the ship. We used to go up on the bow and look down and see the dolphins scooting ahead. Wonderful, really.
So did any of these creatures end up in the kitchen?
Yes, we used to have the occasional flying fish fried for breakfast. And that was lovely.
Were you cooking?
No. Yeah. Oh, we had a cook. How he managed when the ship was in rough water, I don't know, but he always produced hot food. A long-serving chap, possibly from the Navy, a Navy cook, but really knew his stuff. And how he survived in the galley, I'll never know. You know, it's just incredible conditions. Heat in the tropics, and then rolling and swaying around, you know, crossing the roaring 40s and 50s. Well, it must have been horrendous. But the guy was absolutely magic with his pots and pans.
Mm.
Yeah.
Were you having to kind of work your passage? Did he have duties?
We used to chip paint sometimes on the deck and holy stoning, rubbing these brick things up and down the planking to make it nice and white, but just to keep us busy, really, I think. And then we had some huskies on board, which we were taking south, and pups, little husky pups. So we used to make a fuss of those. And painting, you know, painting the anchor white. And, you know, the old in the forces idea, if it doesn't move, paint it. it was same thing on the Bisco. And, of course, we had Captain Johnson in charge. Bill Johnson.
What do you make of him?
Oh, terrific. What a guy. He always appeared to be doing absolutely nothing until there was trouble. And then he was there. But no, wonderful chap. He conveyed the right sort of atmosphere. You know, the right when we were in danger. Like one time the ship began to ice up, and that's really serious. You know, when you get an accumulation of ice, you know, above the waterline, the ship can roll over, and he was cool and calm and got everybody out on the deck hacking at it, and we survived. You know, that was partly down to him. Well, to a big part.
So he was a seasoned operator, wasn't he?
Yes, yes. He gave that impression, and okay. I'm sure he was.
Where did you call on the way?
I've got mixed memories because I did four trips to and fro altogether. The usual first call was the first landfall was going past Madeira, which was a beautiful island to look at from the sea, of course. And then from there, the next port of call would be Cape Verde Islands, where we would get fuel, more fuel. And from there, the next port of call was St. Paul Rocks, which are just jagged rocks sticking up out of the middle of the Atlantic, which are a navigation point, really. There's nothing there but just black rock.
You know, there's no people.
No, and they're just the waves dashing over them. And then from there, one trip we went into Rio de Janeiro because there was a strike in Montevideo. So that was a wonderful, unexpected port of call. We spent 2-3 nights there. then Montevideo next, and other trips on the Biscay. I even managed to get to Punta Arenas, where, of course, you must kiss Magellan's toe. And there's a statue of Magellan in Punta Arenas, and all travellers are requested to kiss his toe so that make sure you come back or something, or make sure you never come back. I'm not quite sure which it is.
And the Falklands, I guess, as well.
Oh, yes, and into the Falklands, yes.
So, I mean, the Falklands was pretty undeveloped in 1952, wasn't it?
Yes, 51. Yeah. No airport of any sort. They did have some Argentinian young people land a plane on the race course.
Oh, yeah. So tell me more.
They sort of the first glimmers of invasion, really. But they couldn't take off again, and no other plane ever attempted it. I think it sort of partly crashed. I don't know the final day, but I know some people from Argentina did fly.
Were you there at the time?
No, it was right. A year or two before.
Yeah, I see.
A year or two before. But but in a way, no airport was the salvation of the Falklands at that point.
How do you mean?
It couldn't be invaded. In a manner of speaking, it was a bit of a bad step to build an airport in some respects, because it meant that once anybody had gained control of it, it was open for invasion. You know, it could.
You were worth invading, weren't you?
Yes. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. But anyway, that's.
Paint me a little thumbnail sketch of Stanley in 1952.
It only had one stretch of proper concrete road, and that had been put in for Prince Philip, and that was 100 yards long, and a tiny town, like a very small Cornish fishing village sort of thing. Corrugated iron roofs, wooden panel buildings, a little cathedral with whale jaw bones outside, which used to be on all the stamps. And the jetties all ended in hulks of windjammers that had been dismasted going round Cape Horn. The old windjammers used to go round Cape Horn, and some made it and some didn't, of course. And if they were badly damaged, they would limp into Port Stanley, and they'd be too expensive to repair, and they would just stay there rotting. And they were used as storage and jetty endings and that sort of thing in the harbour. And, of course, that's what happened eventually to the SS Great Britain, which ended up a long time in the harbour and then finally taken round to Sparrow Cove.
Oh, right, so from the harbour to Sparrow Cove, where she was dumped, effectively.
Yes, just about a couple of miles.
Yeah. OK, we all know where she is now, of course.
Yes.
In Bristol.
Yes, great.
And whilst you were in Stanley, you would have been... briefed about where you were going. Did you know what Sydney Island was when you were told you were
Deception
going?
First.
Oh, Deception, I think.
Yes. And we were sort of told. I mean, I think everybody just accepted, you know, where they were going. Really, it was all unknown, so we had no idea particularly any particular details of each place. And we generally thought of them as being all the same, you know, just a little hut somewhere. But, of course, when you got to know the various dispositions of them, you began to realise that some were slightly better than others. But that came later.
You were kitted up as well. Can you remember what kit you were given?
Yes. Long woolen drawers, underwear that was originally issued for submariners in submarines, of course, and woolly jumpers and windproof tops and trousers and lumberjack boots. What else do we have? Of some nice woolly gloves.
Hats,
yes, and mutlucks. Mm-hmm. The sort of furry Eskimo-type boots that really would keep you warm in when you really got cold. Yeah. For the time, it was good. It was a reasonable equipment.
Was there still ex-army mainly at that time?
Bits and pieces of it were, yes, bits and pieces, yeah. It was all quite good kit. But, of course, nothing like... What you get now, nothing approaching it.
So there you were sailing off to Deception, with your image of the Swiss hills and mountains in your mind.
Yes.
And you couldn't have ended up anywhere more different, could you?
No, no, it's all black. No white, hardly any white.
So what were your feelings at that point, Ray?
Well, I wasn't downcast. I mean, I sort of, on the way to Deception, we'd passed, we'd gone close to other bases. We'd gone to Hope Bay, called in there and dropped people off, and at Admiralty Bay we dropped, which all looked proper Antarctic. But Deception looked so different, it being a black volcano and really relatively recent, you know, in geological terms. Mm. And with quite a bit of snow and ice on it, but of course the impression was mainly black ash. But no, it was great. I sort of really looked forward to it there. And I was quite happy.
What did you see once you got through the bellows, Neptune's bellows?
Well, they're the ruins of the whaling station, and then the nice, really well-preserved Norwegian hut that was going to be our base hut. And really, our hut at Deception was far better than the other ones. The sort of purpose-made ones at Hope Bay and Admiralty Bay and Loch Roy were quite primitive-looking buildings, really. Just like two or three beach huts together. The nice hut we had from the whaling station was excellent. You know, great thick walls full of sawdust, obviously, as insulation, and a nice dormitory upstairs. That was good. I was pleased with that. And, of course, an inexhaustible supply of timber for me to practice for carpentry on.
Yeah, well, I was interested in this. You obviously had a passion for Barry Bucknell-type activities, didn't you?
Oh, yes. Yeah, Barry Putnam, that's history, isn't it?
Well, that's later than this, isn't it? So where were you getting your raw materials from?
From the old whaling station. It had all been sort of pushed over and messed about a bit over the years since the whalers had abandoned it.
Was it well-preserved wood, or was it?
Yes, oh yes, and very high quality, of course. You know, no knots and beautiful Norwegian timber. No, it was an inexhaustible supply of stuff, and I very soon had a workshop down in the old whaling station with a Yukon stove, which I stacked up with timber and got glowing red hot during the winter months. And it's great. And of course we'd picked up a pig, a little piglet in Port Stanley. The radio operator had this brainy idea and bought this little piglet, and we made a little pigsty for it in the old whaling station. And fattened it up for Christmas.
What else did you make with your endless supply of Norwegian timber?
Well, there was always odd jobs to do around the main place we were in, and you know, repairs, shelving, and you know, carpentry. I'd make things, and I sort of built a little slipway for the dinghy, and dinghy maintenance I would do in there, that sort of thing, varnishing up the dinghy and keeping that. Making sure the Seagull outboard motors behaved, because they were desperately temperamental. And although quite often we'd chug out into the bay, you know, when it wasn't iced over, and it would be quite difficult to get the motor going again if you stopped it, and things like that. So maintenance mainly for the dinghies and the various trips we did on the water in the centre of Deception Island.
So where were you learning the maintenance skills? Because you weren't a DEM, were you?
No, but I mean, in the RAF I picked up handiness with tools and engines and stuff. They'd always been, you know, an interest. You know, I'd always help my dad tinker with his car. So, you know, I was okay with engines and that sort of thing.
Most carpenters end up building the base bar. Did you have that fate?
No, but all the bases I went to, they had their own bar, which was quite sufficient. Yeah.
What about the Met work then? That's why you were there.
I'm
intrigued to know why it was so important to Deception. I can see why it was important later when flying began.
Yes.
But why was Met observations at Deception so important before flying began?
It was probably all part of the maintaining our claim to the land. You know, we sort of claimed part the Graham Land Peninsula. We sort of claimed that as part of the empire, so to speak, part of the Falkland dependencies. Mm-hmm. And part of the claim was bolstered by having stamps, having a JP on the base. The base leader was the JP as well. And then doing Met observations was all part of, you know, the general appearance that this was British ground.
Oh, right. I realised that if you started surveying the island, you kind of gained a stronger grip on it.
Yes.
But I hadn't realised that keeping meteorological records also had the same effect.
Absolutely anything that you could do that could faintly conceivably bolster your thing was done. I mean, the Argentines even had the first birth. They took a pregnant lady to their base and had the first baby in the Antarctica. So, you know, that was for their claim. It was all a bit silly, really. You know, the Chileans claimed it as well. Three countries, Argentine, Chile and Great Britain, and the Falklands claimed, you know, that particular bit of ground and all did their best to, cheaply as possible, to to keep their flag flying.
In that case, does that mean that you didn't need to take the Met observations too seriously?
Oh, no. We were trained meteorologists, so we did it properly. Yes. We actually got up at 3 a.m.
You did?
We didn't cook it up at 9 the next
day. The very suggestion is suspicious, right?
Yes.
So tell me about the daily routine of Met observations in Deception.
Every 4 hours. Every 3 hours, sorry. Right through the whole 24 hours, so obviously midnight, 3 a.m, 6 and so on. And you do wind speed, air pressure, temperature, dew point and dry bulb, you know, so you could work out how humid the atmosphere was. And cloud cover, whether the pressure was going up or down and rising and falling. The proper meteorological coded message was put together.
Were you sending up balloons at this point?
Yes, but just for wind direction, which we'd follow with a small theodolite. And we didn't do that too often because it was quite often cloudy and Deception, so you couldn't follow it very often. But later on we did proper radio sonde at Argentine Islands. But we took the weather observing very seriously because there was 3 of us doing it, and so we could have time off from it. It wasn't, you know, we did it 2 days on and 1 day off, I think. And it wasn't unduly arduous. And it left plenty of time for skiing and walking and hill walking, a bit of mountaineering, using the ice axe for the first time, photography, because the bird life is fantastic. You know, photographing everything that moved.
Did you have a dark room?
Yes. Yeah, we used to do our own developing and printing. I'm not sure I ever really mastered printing. It's quite a mysterious art, printing a photograph. But no, we had all the equipment that we'd need for that. I just bought a new, very posh camera in Port Stanley. Spent a whole year's salary on it.
The number of times I've heard somebody say that.
Yes.
You know, must be a very good camera shop in Stanley.
Oh, yes.
What was happening to the weather recordings you were making? Who was getting them?
Well, they were sent, I think there were 2 periods in the day when we ran the generators and the radio transmitter was working. We had a wireless operator who would, using Morse code, would send the messages to Port Stanley where they were collected. And what they did with them, I wouldn't know, but that, because later on all that sort of thing is collected in a worldwide network, you know, sort of moment by moment. But no, they were all sent off properly. And of course there would be other Morse messages for the running of the base, you know, ordering up new supplies. And the wireless operator was a very important job, really. And we had some wonderful, highly skilled wireless operators, you know, people that had been trained during the war and who was absolutely mustered at the Morse code. And they were really great guys, in the main, the wireless ops.
Did you ever forecast the weather as well?
No. That would have come later, I suppose, when the aircraft got more and more used. But there were no aircraft there. While I was down south, there were no aircraft. So that came a bit later.
What else were you able to do? I mean, you were out skiing. Did you take the dogs out much?
It used to be a full-time job feeding them. Because you had to catch seals, kill seals for dog food, and they were fed 4 pounds of meat every other day, nothing else, just a great hunk of seal meat, skin and bone and the whole lot. And that was quite a job that initially one thought, oh, I don't want to do this.
Oh, killing seals?
Yes. But, sad to say, one very soon got used to it, you know, because everybody sort of mucked in and you didn't... there was never any thought of, oh, I'm not going to do that sort of thing. You know, we all did what was required of us, and occasionally, you know, you went out in the dinghy and or went out over the sea ice and killed a seal. And, of course, you had to build up a stock for the winter, which was in a great frozen heap during the really cold midwinter period. You know, that would be quite an arduous job to pull a carcass out, saw it up with a great big double-handed saw, and then feed it to the dogs every other day.
So it was fed to the dogs frozen, was it?
Yes, yes.
And the dogs had to gnaw away.
They loved it. They really looked forward to it. And, of course, the dogs were fantastic.
Well, were you actually using them as a team of huskies or not?
No, just great pals. You know, we always made a fuss of them and, you know, went out and rolled around on the snow with them and stuff.
But, really?
Yes. Oh, yes. They were... There was only one occasion when I've heard of somebody being bitten by a husky, and that was when he was rolling around on the snow with his particular friendly husky, and he playfully bit the husky's ear. And the dog immediately bit his lip. But that's the only occasion. They were absolutely harmless to human beings, but they would sort of fight to the death with each other. Or any penguin happened to stray too near, you know, that would be a goner immediately. Yeah. Yes. But
was there any kind of organised breeding program, or was it just Mother Nature?
Some of the bases, I think they had, Hope Bay, I think they had a breeding program. And of course, the reason we had huskies at the other bases was to keep somewhere the spare huskies, as they were, the spare teams, because they couldn't all be kept at Hope Bay. You know, we must have had 10 or 12 teams of dogs. Mm. So they couldn't stay at all at one base, even though they were only, at that time, they were only needed at one base as sledge dogs. So they were shifted around, you know, during the summer months on the boat as required to Hope Bay for the mapping teams, you know, mapping sledge journeys. So that was what was going on, really, with the dogs.
What was daily life on the base like? Were you... presumably you all had to muck in together. I forget how many there were of you. 8 or 9?
Seven.
Seven,
yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, we all worked in... we all did a week of cooking, which was...
How did you take to that? Because that was new to you, wasn't it? Cooking?
Yes, I'd never done it. But I loved it. I didn't mind it at all. You know, it was a week when I could concentrate on one thing and really put my mind to it, you know. And I produce rolls, cakes, buns, you know, all sorts of
baking
things.
So
yes, baking. Oh yes, yeah. Very soon knew how to make a loaf, you know, and how to make bread, and we've had, you know, everything to hand, all dried, of course, but it was all eatable, you know, passable, especially in a hungry state. Mm. But it was a challenge, you know, which I quite liked. I mean, occasionally somebody would hate it, but they would still do it. You know, you didn't let anybody off their week. You know, you had to do a week on cooking.
Was there any evidence of the volcanic nature of the island whilst you were there?
Yes, the hot springs were bubbling away on the beach all the time.
Did you take advantage of those?
You could say that, yes.
How could I say it?
Well, it seems it's an obvious thing to say, if you don't mind me saying so. That I tried a paddle, and I could see the hot water coming up out of the sand, and I thought, right, I'll have a paddle around here. Took my shoes and socks off, rolled up my trousers and strolled into the water. And, of course, I was immediately severely burnt in a tiny narrow band round my calf, and the rest of the water was freezing cold because the hot water that was bubbling up was settling out into a narrow layer on the top of the water.
Oh, right.
It wasn't stirred up. So although it It was hot.
So it was inverted, the yes. hot water on the top?
Yes. You had a quarter of an inch of hot, very hot, and the rest was absolutely freezing. So, you know, it was oh, I won't try that again.
Well, I think later bases kind of took a spade or something and mixed the water up first.
Yeah, quite possibly. Yeah, we never thought of it.
Yeah.
It's quite surprising when you talk to people that have been to the same base as you have, either before or after, the different things that people thought of doing that you never thought of. You know, other things you did think that they never did, and it's quite surprising how each year when the change took place, although there were people that stayed over from previous times, you didn't exactly pick up where the previous people had left off. You know, I later found out that on Deception there were caverns that you could walk under the snow, under the ice, where the snow was melted out, where it touched the ground and was over the top. Never saw them. Never had an idea there was anything like that there. And then on the other hand, you know, we used to climb over the rim of the crater and go and get penguin eggs. You know, other years they didn't do that. So it was quite surprising, you know, how clean cut the difference was between one year and another.
So were you not reading the previous year's base reports? Then?
Yes.
Were?
Yes.
Yeah, but I guess that kind of stuff didn't get into the report.
No.
Which is why we're doing these interviews now.
Oh, right.
Yeah, partially
yeah.
anyway.
Yeah.
Apart from the endless supply of Norwegian timber, was there any other relics of the whaling industry that came in handy?
Yes, the gunpowder.
The gunpowder, go on.
Yeah, we used to have wonderful explosions and occasionally we'd load a sledge up with 7 or 8 boxes of gunpowder and push it around on the flat snow surface, you know, a mile or two up the beach from the base, laying a long trail of gunpowder. And then perhaps a diesel drum upended over 2 or 3 cases at the far end, and then we'd retreat. I mean, the trail of gunpowder to the explosive site was 200 yards, 300 yards long, so it left us plenty of time to retreat to a safe point. And then we'd leg it up the nearest cliff and watch the fire. And, of course, you get a curtain of fire tracking along through the snow from your trail. You know, the curtain of fire would be about 12, 15 foot high, you know, roaring along. And then it would disappear and you'd think, oh, it's gone out, you know, as it went under the drum. And then there'd be a pause and a great big bang in a huge cloud of smoke, and then the diesel drum would appear about 200 feet, 300 feet up, sailing out of the top of the cloud. So it was all great fun, and we'd all cheer like mad and, you know, go back to the base.
Was this November the 5th or midwinter?
Oh, any time we felt cheering up. Yeah, but there must have been 3 or 4 tonnes of gunpowder on the beach in various scows, various wooden barges that the Norwegians had left behind. There were other mysterious things in it, like in these barges, like detonators and things, but we carefully steered clear of those because we thought they might be dangerous.
Were there neighbours by this time? Were the Argentinians on the island?
Yes, they were about 6-7 miles away.
What do they make of these sudden...
Oh, never heard.
Did he ever have anything to do with them?
Yes, they on my second summer, just before I was changing bases, the Norwegians appeared and built a little hut, a rescue hut, very, very close to the Biscoe house, about 100 yards away. And we thought it was far too close, so we radioed Port Stanley and told them what was going on. And as far as I was aware, that was the end of it. But about 6 weeks later, a Navy frigate appeared with a load of Marines on board, and they surrounded this little building at 6 in the morning. And they picked up a policeman from Port Stanley, the only policeman from Port Stanley, and he walked up the steps of this building and knocked on the door and said, "I'm arresting you in the name of the Queen of England," sort of thing. And we've arrested these 3 Argentinian Navy men inside, and the hut was knocked down and burnt by the Marines. And it was quite exciting, and we had a little squad of Marines that were based in the hut with us for the rest of that summer.
What, to protect you?
Yes.
Against any retaliation?
That's right. And we used to have periodic visits by various frigates The snipe went off straight away with the three prisoners who were taken to South Georgia and handed over to the Argentinian whaling station that was operating there then. And later on we had a visit from Bigby Bay and various frigates. They'd come in and see how we're getting on and see how the Marine squad that they left behind was getting on.
So the three Argentinians in your observation hut, were they part of the Argentinian base elsewhere in Deception?
I think they were Navy personnel.
Ah, right. So,
yes.
Okay.
Yes. So it was.
So they were just being cheeky, were they?
Yes, yes. But Churchill was Prime Minister at the time, so I think he probably took a poor view of it.
What about this poor policeman? He was a long way from his beat, wasn't he?
It was, yeah. And I mean, he couldn't have had any idea what his reception would be, you know, waking these... I mean, he could have been shot or anything. You know, if they'd have been a bit trigger-happy. It was quite a tricky moment. The hut was surrounded by the Royal Marines, all down on one knee with their rifles cocked and pointed. It was quite dramatic.
Like a circle of Airfix men.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. And, of course, four days later, we were overflown by a Lancaster bomber, of all things, with Argentinian markings on, to see what had gone on. And when we sort of all waved at it as it flew by at about 20 feet. And then a few minutes later, we looked at each other and thought, I wonder if we just avoided death by... I mean, anything could have happened.
So. How was it then to have an attachment to Marines disturbing your otherwise tranquil life? Because a base becomes quite a unit, doesn't it?
Yes.
And then suddenly another dozen guys turn up with a different ethos.
Yes. Oh, they were great, actually. We used to go out in the dinghy and drop demolition charges over the side to see if we could bring up any fish. You know, all sorts of things. They were up for anything. They're nice chaps. We got on well. Yeah, and of course, they were saved from square bashing and polishing and stuff.
So they were happy to be there, were they?
Oh, well happy, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Let's just pause for a minute, Ray.